Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Part 2 on O.J. Simpson, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ron Goldman. The tragedy and violence that occurred both within the sphere of people, but also the tragedies boiling around them. It was a time of true strife in Los Angeles, and this story only made it more poignant. What was called the Trial of the Century occurred amongst the backdrop of one of the most distressing events in LA history.
Exactly, how do you feel about all of this?
I feel that it's a great travesty of justice. I feel that the jury in Simi Valley gave the okay to continue to abuse and oppress and suppress black people in this country. I feel that there is an undercurrent of racism and that the system is rotten to the
core. So these people, it's not an organized effort, you're telling me?
This is not an organized effort. These are concerned citizens. We are the people. We are Rodney King's peers. We are Ula Mae Love's peers. We are Latasha Harlan's peers. Not that jury and Ventura.
Maybe you can join us here real quickly. Do you have any sense this is organized or is this going to keep growing? What is it?
I don't know if it's going to keep growing. I hope it keeps growing. We need all the support we can. I mean, we are his peers. We're the group of peers.
This is a demonstration that was promised after the verdict came in and materialized quite some time ago. This tape is from a few minutes ago. I can tell you, and I don't know whether we'll see it on the tape. Well, now you see people throwing stuff at, I assume to be rocks, maybe dirt, at the front of Parker Center. Involving the four officers accused in the beating of Rodney King.
We're being told that several patrol cars have been surrounded near Parker Center downtown. All of the officers in the Central Division are being instructed to put on their helmets.
They're just marching up and down the streets, and they formed a big bulkhead here at the end of the corner.
And okay.
Yeah, thank you very much. As you can see, they just keep storming the cops on every side. The officers are trying to hold them back, and they're just storming in there.
Well, so far, I've seen no aggressive moves on the part of the officers. They seem to be just standing their ground, Linda.
I'm sorry, Paul, could you repeat that?
I say the officers just seem to be standing their ground. I don't see any aggressive moves by them.
Who's been hurt?
Absolutely.
Today? Could you give us
what
an update on that?
What do you think I'm talking about, ma'am?
No, I mean, just now. I have not been able to see
anything. No, I can't give you an update right now, except this is a life and threatening situation, and we need your cooperation. If you wanted to turn your lights on, do it on the crowd, not on the officers. They're just standing here.
You can see right now they're just jumping on it. They're tearing it up. They're smashing it with their feet.
Well, this has changed a lot since the beginning when it was more or less a war of nerves between the two sides, and now it seems to be more violent, Linda.
See the smoke?
You can see the fire.
There you go. There.
Linda, while we're looking at you, we can tell you now at least five major fires have broken out in South Central.
Simpson stumbled into secondaries he once danced around and was soon buried beneath the rubble of the rebuilding 49ers.
Could that lack of control or not being on top of the top influence his ultimate demise? Because he retired shortly thereafter.
Finally, with a magic drain from his legs, O.J. Simpson bid farewell to the game that had been his life.
I want to tell you that over the years, I've heard your applause and I appreciated your cheers. And I want you to know that I already know it's what I'm going to miss most. Thank you all very much.
Or could it have been other tragedies that hit home? In the midst of his last few years with the NFL, O.J. experienced tragedy himself. The worst of the worst thing occurred for any parent. While O.J. was out of town, his daughter died in a swimming pool accident. That is true heartbreak. He would rarely bring this up to his close friends. He said in a TV interview, it doesn't really affect him, or he tries to not let it affect him. He likes to live his life to the fullest, but he has major pain behind his eyes when he talks about this. He lost a child. He was away when it happened, and he said he was always away, and that cost him his marriage to Marguerite, most likely. Or possibly it was the cheating, you know. Or maybe the loss of a child. Often, many marriages don't survive that type of trauma. It's so painful. A few weeks prior to OJ losing his daughter, One of his close friends had lost his son to a similar pool accident at a local athletic club. That friend says in the documentary, he never really talked about it, but he knew that it affected OJ. He said, my son's death still affects me to this day, so I know that it affects OJ. OJ eventually delves into his acting career after he retires from the NFL and delves into his new relationship with young Nicole Brown. They dated for years before finally tying the knot in 1985, 5 years after his retirement from the NFL and 5 years from his divorce. Brown and Simpson met in 1977 and married in 1985, and they had a daughter and son together. Their wedding seemed pretty epic by all accounts. The tall, waify blonde married the pillar of masculinity and athleticism. Champagne flowed, speeches were given, and the couple seemed genuinely in love.
With each other. And we've talked about the God dimension. And we've talked about how important the great adhesive of the Father is in the middle of a marriage to keep two people together in happiness and joy and creativity and living fully together. I am grateful that you're endeavoring to settle the issue, OJ, that it's more important to have a life than to make a living. And I'm very grateful that you're starting this relationship with Nicole with a new kind of commitment to the Father. For it's within that kind of commitment that you'll be far more than you ever could have been to Nicole. Love sees things from the other's point of view. And we're very grateful that you now have received divine love and pass that love on to others. I just trust that by the way you live and by the way you treat others, OJ, by the way you value life, that you will lead Nicole to say continually with breathless wonder, oh God, I'm a woman most fortunate, for out of all of this world, OJ has chosen me. Be that kind of man.
But what's eerie to think about is the first domestic abuse call to 911 happened that year, 1985, the year the dashing couple were married. And side note, and trigger warning, this episode is going to depict violence and abuse emotionally and physically, and it's overall very hard to hear. And I'll say this, if you or someone you know is experiencing abuse, you are not alone, and there are resources. The domestic abuse hotline can be reached at 1-800-799-7233 or connect just directly online at hotline.org. Early on in their marriage, Nicole realized that OJ was a habitual womanizer. His closest friends even say it in the documentary. Robert Kardashian appears to be, I think, in a police interrogation about OJ, and he says, yeah, I would basically conduct my marriage that way. He said, quote, while he was married, his integrity was not as I would have it. Let's put it that way. In the documentary as well, Nicole's own friend states that OJ tried to come onto her and she had to push him off. OJ thought a lot of OJ. He went out of his way to almost rub his cheating in Nicole's face. For example, he would be in Las Vegas, holding hands with another woman publicly, knowing he was being filmed at like a fight night type thing. Just kind of rubbing it in her face, and she would be at home with a baby, and it tortured her. And her friends testify to that. Most of their fights were caused by his incessant affairs. His friend, and the one with the voice I said last episode that I like so much, cute voice, from the doc, Joe Bell, warned OJ that you are breaking the laws of God, and nobody does that with immunity. No one thought it was cute that OJ was breaking poor Nicole's heart. And OJ doubled down on the abuse by telling her the reason for him having an affair with Tawny Kitaen, which, if you know classic rock or 80s hair bands, Tawny was the famous girl from Whitesnake's music videos, Still of the Night, Is This Love, and Here I Go Again on My Own. Okay, I should never sing, but that's the one that I know most poignantly. where she rolls around, flips her hair, and does the splits on the top of a car. You know it. You've seen it. She was a hot ticket, and rest in peace as well, Tawny. She struggled with substance misuse disorder and died fairly recently. But she was also a great beauty and was also sort of used and abused and passed around by rock stars and sports stars, obviously, and sort of just left to flounder. It's a very sad reality. But I digress. OJ blamed this affair on Nicole getting fat when she was pregnant and saying he didn't want to have sex with her anymore. Now we're really starting to get into what kind of a selfish, bad person OJ Simpson is. So, a big aspect of this case is the timing of the Rodney King beating. The heartbreaking, televised beating of a troubled man, but from what I heard from my friend Jennifer, a sweet man. So, on the backdrop of the city, the black community, in fury and pain after watching Rodney be beat, and after suffering their own injustices to rally behind a black man, for better or worse, OJ became the poster child for the timing of what had just happened. Yet sadly, OJ didn't seem to stand by his own. He was OJ, not black, not white. He was OJ, in his own words. Meanwhile, the community fought for him, believed in him, without a semblance of reciprocation on his part. Again, this is all opinion on my part, but it's sourced from research, but it does seem that OJ did OJ, and that's what he set his sights on. So, while researching this, I thought of my sweet darling of a friend, Jennifer Jimenez. You would recognize her as a supermodel in the 90s, 2000s, and beyond, with a story I'd actually love to cover on this podcast. I did it on my former podcast, Be Here for a While, but yeah, she's just a really cool person with a really cool story and just a beautiful person and a stunning model who was discovered as a child, went on to be an actress in one of the most iconic scenes in Blow, one of my favorite movies, by the way, and also by way of her own rehab journey, became a house mom on the TV show Sober House with Drew Pinsky. She was a beacon of help and a punching bag at certain points when Steven Adler from Guns N' Roses came back into the house and messed up, you know, he had relapsed, But rest in peace for him. Addiction is a terrible thing, and I imagine he was a kind person, just a lost and addicted soul. But along with him, Jennifer spent an immense amount of time with Rodney King. She truly loved him. And he is integral to this story. And rest in peace, Rodney, yourself. You did seem like a sweet person. I used to watch that show and I kind of fell in love with your kindness and sweetness. You just seemed like a doll. And so is Jennifer. And here's my conversation with my friend, Jennifer.
Hello.
Hi.
So, I've been deep diving into the O.J. Simpson story. I'm probably going to do 3 episodes on it now. But, yeah, I thought about you because I was like, O.J. cheated on Nicole with Tawny Kattan. And then also, in one of the documentaries I've been like using for my research, they really do reference the Rodney King incident a ton because it happened like right before the murder of Nicole and Ron Goldman.
You know, it's funny because Rodney and I actually got really close. Like I was one of his like point people because we were so close. And there's so many things that people don't know about Rodney King. First of all, he is a kind, kind, kind man. But there's a lot of stuff that Rodney shared with me that was really personal. And it's funny, I say it was really personal while we were shooting, but like, you know, we forget about the cameras, you know, when we're shooting this stuff and you're living with someone for a month. And, you know, I had a lot of sympathy for him because he had such a sweet face and he was such a kind person from the moment I met him. And the more Rodney and I would talk, You know, I remember this thing, it changed my life, actually. I remember I was sitting with him one day, and I think we might have been in the jacuzzi, I know it sounds weird, or we might have been like by the poolside at when we're shooting Sober House. And I was like, Rodney, out of all these people, like out of anyone that I know, like you have the right to really hate or be angry at these officers that did such a brutal job to you. Like they beat you. They you know, gave you damage inwardly. Like they tore your life apart. And I'm like, how do you feel like towards them? Have you ever seen them? And he goes, Jen, I don't have hate. And I looked at him. I go, excuse me? He goes, I have no hate for these cops. I actually had to forgive them. I forgave them first, and they were pretty shocked. He goes, I can't live with that hate that they had for me because it would kill me. And I say this to you right now, and I have the goosebumps, like, because
he literally,
it does make you want to cry. Like, this man taught me the greatest gift of forgiveness. You know, this man was so, I mean, we all watched it, right? Like how brutally attacked he was. And he didn't have any hate for them and only love. And he said he prayed for them all the time. What? Like, what? And then, like, you know, he got a lot of money, you know, and he got a lot of money given to him for the settlement. And I said, did you at least save your money? And he goes, no, everyone came into my life and they all took it. People I knew, friends of mine, family member, everyone. And he talked really highly of his kids and, you know, they never damaged him or anything like that. But, like, he was talking to me about how he had, you know, whatever it was, hundreds of millions or 97, I don't even know what it was. It was an outrageous amount of money. And he lost every single penny because everyone came in and he didn't know. I mean, like, you know, when you don't have money and everyone, you get this money, everyone starts, you know, we call them the coattail hanger-oners or I don't even know what the new word would be today of those people. But, you know, all these yes and people came into his life and they all stole everything and ran, you know, and I'm like, again, damaged. And as I got to know him, you know, I was just like, he would only look at me and like, we would look and I'd be like, you're okay. You know, especially when mayhem was going on. Cause of course we're shooting Sober House and there's so much mayhem because literally what people didn't realize about those shows is that you're talking about an addict or alcoholic who is literally the first year of their life. It's a fact that your brain is telling you without a drink or a drug, you will die. Then you put cameras on these people and it doesn't necessarily say it in these words, right? You're going to die if you drink or use. It says you're different than them. You got this. They don't understand. You know, it starts talking to you, the disease, right? And these people were so new in recovery and like their brains are playing this war at them and they're just trying to like survive, right? And then you put cameras on them and of course everything's going to be amplified. One of the craziest things that happened with Rodney and I'm sorry, I'm just talking, but I have
I'm very interested about this. No, I'm very
good. One of the crazy things that happened was, I think it was day two or three of Sober House. Steven Adler was high and like we figured out he was high and they threw a party. They decided to throw a party. And so anyone could come, like all their friends and family could come over. So like, of course, bad friends were coming over and all this stuff. And
is that when Steven actually attacked you, kind of? I remember watching this.
He did attack me later on that night after the party ended. He attacked me. He actually tried to beat the shit out of me. Excuse my language. He was so high. And I remember at one point I looked at the producer. I'm like, he's high. He's dying. I can't stand by this. Like, what are you guys doing? And Drew was like doing Loveline at the time. And it was late at night now because the party had ended. We knew it was high. We kept him away from everyone. We give everyone their meds, right? Everyone's going to sleep, the rest of the cast of the clients, you know, in the house. And I get them all to sleep. We have, you know, Steven in one room and he's just trying, he ends up beating me, like hitting me, throwing things at me. I got physically abused by him. And I remember I had called one of the producers and I said, this guy's turning green, like do something. And they said, well, you need to do it. And I was like, what? They're like, yep, you're the house manager. It's your job. I'm like, what do I do? And we wanted to put him, Steven Adler, into a detox. So I called 911 and said, we have someone here using. Well, they didn't realize we were shooting a podcast. I mean, we were a podcast, a reality show. It took the cops 5 hours to get there. Now, mind you, it's the wee hours of the morning and he's getting worse and worse. And finally the cops come. They're like, well, we didn't know it was a show being shot. We would have come earlier or whatever. It's kind of funny what they said. And we're like, we need
to see, why would they have come earlier? Because it was a show. Like, why?
I know. Isn't that weird? Yeah. So they come into the house and they go, three cops come directly upstairs and they walk in front of me. Now, at the time, Rodney had gotten up to go to the restroom. What do the cops do? They walk straight into the first door they could see, which is the restroom. Rodney's taking a piss. Rodney turns around with one eye. And mind you, he's deep in sleep. We have him medicated, right? On the med, you know, he's deep, you know, he's nearly sober. And he looks and he sees cops. Could you imagine that poor guy's fucking face and like what he felt like?
Oh my God.
And the
yes.
cops freaked out. They screamed and walked in. They're like, oh my God, what is he doing here? Like, and they had no idea. So like Rodney is in like hysteria. So I'm in the bathroom trying to push the cops out. And I don't care about the cops. I care about Rodney because like I have this relationship with them and I'm the house manager. So I'm like, look at my eyes, me and you, you're fine. You're fine. Sorry about the cops. Like, you know, and he's like, what's going on? And this poor guy, like, you know, we're talking, having him talk about like his issues and all this stuff. And, you know, we're trying to keep him in a safe environment. We have cops coming into his bathroom while he's taking a pee at like 4 a.m, right? Like that is a scary thing for anybody, let alone someone like Rodney King. So then the cops run out and then they have to wait for their head. Like they have to call in that Rodney King's there. And it was like a whole ordeal because Rodney King was there. Right. And all my focus at this point was like calming Rodney down and making sure that his, like, I mean, he went into a trauma filled, you know, psychosis at that moment, you know, and I'm just trying to get the cops to take Steven to detox, not knowing he had drugs on him. So, I mean, it was like a whole ordeal, but like, that's something like behind the scenes that like nobody knows about. But it was a moment. Like I've had some, I had some serious moments with Rodney. Like, you know, he was very deep, you know, and he had brain damage. And I asked him, is the brain damage from the cops, you know? And he said, no, it's from my childhood too. And I found out more stuff. And
oh, no.
This poor guy, like, was born with a dealt. He was dealt a hand of cards that were really fucked, you know, and like. It's so sad because he really wanted it. He really just wanted to be a father and like wanted his life back, you know, and he was on the road to it and he was doing well. And like, my fear was that like, oh, you know, Rodney, like I kept in touch for a while with him and then he kind of stopped keeping in touch with me. And when they stopped keeping in touch with me, I kind of know things are going sideways. And then sure enough, like he dies, you know, just like that, like drowns. And it was just a devastating death because we had just, I don't know, I think we lost right after that. We lost Mike Starr from the show. And there was like some more deaths from the show that were happening. But the Rodney King passing for me was a devastation because I had such a tight bond with him and he shared so much. And I remember at one point I was sitting there with like the whole cast and, you know, you had Andy Dick and Steven Adler, Seth, you know, Binzer. You had, you know, you just had a lot of people there. And I just remember going, what does it feel like being, knowing that you're going to be in history books for the rest of the eternity? Like, you know, you're a historical figure. And he's like, I don't look at myself that way. Like, he just didn't have that in him, you know, like he never, you know, he never looked at himself as like this grand guy or this famous guy. He just looked at this himself. It's like, how am I going to get by kind of guy? You know, and there's a sadness.
I remember, so like way before you and I even met, I used to watch that show, and I remember very much like kind of like falling in love with him in like a heartbreaking way, just like
yes.
He seemed so painfully sweet. And what's so interesting about like the whole O.J. Simpson thing with Rodney King, like, you know, basically, I'll give you a quick, like, backstory or whatever, but, like, O.J., which obviously you know who he is, but he was very unwilling to be a part of, like, civil rights movement stuff at all. Like, he was, he was like, he was like, I'm not black, I'm OJ. And
yeah,
he was manipulative and he skated by and he, I mean, but he was a brilliant athlete. I will say that. But like, the Rodney King incident happens and the you know, the riots happen afterwards, and OJ could fucking care less. Like, he just didn't. And it was what's really disgusting, I think, about OJ is that. Once he was arrested, the black community, like, circled around him. They were like, oh, like, we support the Jews, like whatever. And OJ, after he was arrested, he's in the police car, and he says, I can't say the word, but what are all these N-words doing in Brentwood right now or whatever? Like, even though they were there to support him, like, being like, oh, like, so all of a sudden, though, then when his trial happens, he's now, like, whatever. He's now a black man on trial.
He
turned it. But it's sad to me that, like, Rodney King never got the – well, I mean, I guess he got money for it, but that was such a horrific thing. And O.J. would never stand up for – like, he was called by, I think, the Olympic Commission, because he was an Olympic athlete, too. He was a track runner as well, to stand up. Like, a bunch of black athletes were, you know, standing up for – you know, rights or whatever, and he was like, nah, not doing it. It just makes me a little grossed out.
I mean, he never participated in his community. It's like, I'm a Latin girl, right? I participate in, like, my Latin community. I'm not shameful of it at all. I'm not shameful that my first language is Spanish, and then I learned English. Like, I'm so, like, it's so weird how, like, you had two African-American men put on trial for obviously two different situations, or got put in the spotlight for two different situations, and one decides, OJ, in my opinion, tries to run off of the card that Rodney King was running off of, right? Everyone wanted victory for Rodney, and he got it, but not really. You know what I mean? He didn't get it because those people got acquitted, mm-hmm. You know, and then you got OJ, and it's like everyone's angry about the Rodney thing, and they want someone to get acquitted for Rodney's mistakes, but they let someone go who pretty much probably was, like, my opinion. I don't know. I'm not a judge. I wasn't one of the people jurors there, but, like, it looks like OJ pretty much did it. I mean, I don't know. I don't know who else could have done it.
And we'll say in our opinion, yes.
In my opinion,
You are correct that OJ. That's what's gross about it. He got to use Rodney's, you know, horrible situation to piggyback on because then they wanted to be like, oh, the LAPD's too bad to black men, like. Let's let OJ off. Like, it really is gross.
Yeah, it is gross. And, you know, it's really sad that, like, Mark Furman is the one that, like, literally threw it all out because of one person. They didn't base their logical, like, they didn't use their sense to use logic in the sense of, like, that's one shitty cop. Now, let's take that away. Could he have done it? You know what I mean? Like, so he didn't take arthritis medications and he's wearing gloves that don't fit right now. Looks like the gloves would have fit if they gave him his art, or if he took his, you know, medication that he was supposed to take for arthritis. Like, it's just weird. And then he ran on the Rodney case, and again, two different cases, you know, two different situations. Yeah.
I'm
weird.
Also, Jen, I'm very impressed with the fact that you just threw out the Mark Furman, like the fact that you know this just off the top of your head is impressive because it's taken me 2 weeks to research.
Girl, I watch everything on the O.J. Simpson trial. I'm fascinated by it. Like, I'm just fascinated that, like, we couldn't get it right, you know, that we let down these two people that passed away, and we let them, like, I say we, not me. Well, I mean, I'm part of it. I'm part of society. Like, you know, I mean, I just feel like they were let down. And again, like, two unsolved mystery murders, still unsolved, you know, and it's so agonizing to me to see, especially with all the, like, the abuse that happened and
the cheating he did,
like, the way he was, you know, that girl was doomed. And, like, being a woman and being an abuse survivor,
she had her
really
jeans ripped on their first date. Did you ever see that?
I think it sounds familiar about the jeans, but I wouldn't put it past her.
She was 18 years old. They go on their first date and she comes back. And I think he's gay, but he seems like her, like, best gay friend, waited up for her all night. And she comes back and her jeans are ripped apart. First date, her jeans are ripped.
Yeah.
And he's like, Nicole, like, what happened. She's like, well, like OJ just got a little like too aggressive or too whatever. I can't remember exactly what she said. And he's like, that's not okay. That's not okay.
Yeah. Like, it wasn't
right from the jump.
It's just awful. I mean, it's just, it's a sad fucking story. It's so sad. You know, it's a tragic case for both of them because Rodney ended up dying in a fucking pool, like swimming drunk. Like, how do you die in a pool?
Well,
like, he loved his pool. Like, he talked about it all the time. He talked about, like, getting his pool and his kids together and this and that. And it's like, it's just so sad to know that he died that way.
Do you know what's
alone.
Bizarre? And that is heartbreaking. And I do remember knowing that that's how he died. But do you know what's bizarre is, I don't know if you know this, OJ's, I think his youngest daughter died in a drowning accident in their pool. He wasn't there. But
wow.
But yeah, like, but what's so creepy about him, and maybe I'm being too hard on him, but I don't think so. I think he's a complicated person, but I think he's probably mostly a piece of shit. But
yeah.
In interviews afterwards, like people would ask him and he would be like, you know, like I try to live my life to the fullest. I don't really think about it. Like I would be like, I need to be hospitalized. If losing a child is the worst thing that can fucking happen to you. And he's just like, yeah, I'm just kind of OJ.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's so insane. It's like, he's like a sociopath. I mean, like the behavior of what I've seen from footages and like people that I knew that knew him, or like I knew a girl that dated her son, his son. And like during that time, and like, they were very, very protective, you know, and like over him. And like, it was just like this whole, like he's bigger than God kind of thing. And it's like, no, man, he's just a human being. That's really kind of probably, in my opinion, and I work in the addiction field. Probably had a serious drug problem and alcohol problem, and definitely like played it off. But like the abuse, the drugs, the alcohol, the hitting, the beating people, kids, wife, whatever. I don't know the wife and all that. I know the wife, but I don't know about the kids. But like just that whole thing, it's like the same dynamic. It's so textbook in a thing, not the murdering type, but right. Not the murdering part of it, but just his behavior. Like, it's sociopath, you know, like
it's,
this grandiosity
it's
that he had.
Yeah, I
but we made
that.
Him like that. America made him like that. He became our hero. I was too young of my time, and let alone yours, but like he was America's hero, you know, and like people didn't want to see heroes go down. Now, you know, it's funny. It's interesting that you're doing this story in this time, because this day and age, it's so different, you know, like people like to, you know, beat up on good people on social media or the press, you know, it's called the social media press now. And back then, you know, they were protecting him and making him feel look bigger than God. And now you see somebody doing bad, they'll take you down, the whole entire, you know, social media.
Oh, they'll take you down as quickly as possible. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, and
but
they
he was such a hero to people. Like, that's why he was able to like meld his way into like the white community and like Brentwood or whatever, where like, there was maybe only like 3 black people that lived in that neighborhood, which is all bullshit. Meaning,
yeah.
Like I don't stand by any of it. But the fact that he was somehow able to seamlessly transcend his race and be like, which no one should be bad to someone for their race, but I just believe he was a sociopath. I think it's because he didn't care about what his like brothers and sisters were going through.
Mm-hmm. No, he didn't.
He didn't care. He didn't care.
No, he didn't care at all. And like, that's the thing. Like, then you got someone like Rodney King who like, even when he was getting beat, he was like saying, stop, please. Like, he was sweet about it. Like, you know what I mean? It wasn't like,
he
was
my
like,
heart, God.
I know it's a breaking. I'm not laughing at that, but it's like, if you really watch the footage of him, right. And like, people really watch that footage of him getting beat. He's not like, he's resisting. He's not doing anything. It was just those fucked up cops, you know, that did that shit. And like, then, you know, they acquit the cops. Like, the guy can't even get like a fair trial. Like, right. And then, and I get why everybody else was pissed and all the African-American community was so upset that, like, you know, we got to get it for OJ, the juice, because we didn't get it for Rodney, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, But they're two different cases, and we need to get the right case. Like, you know,
But that's what's gross about OJ is that, like, the people that were rooting for OJ didn't know that he could care fucking less about them. Like, that's
about exactly. He did not care about the African American community. He proved it. I mean, it's not something that you and I are just kind of saying out of our asses. Like, it's a fact. I mean, look at all the things that he contributed to or didn't contribute to. Look at, like, where was he when all this racial injustice was happening? Did we see him marching ever? No. Did you see him talking about the racial injustice? No. But when he was behind bars, you know, his team decided to use the racial card and use racial injustice and everything else that he was never doing for someone who really needed it, like Rodney King. No one was behind Rodney King. And that's the sad thing is, like, society and the courts, just, they failed Rodney King. You know, and the police and all that, they failed him. And what we then they went and we failed OJ's victims, you know, Nicole and God, why did I just have a brain fart?
Ron Goldman.
I mean, we failed these two people. Like, that guy was young. He was just bringing back a bag, you know, and even if he wasn't just bringing back a bag, right? Like, she
even
was
if they
single.
Were looking up, who cares? Like,
I know,
cares?
They were single. Like, OJ, I mean, like, he was dating, like you said, someone else. He was dating, he was
Tawny
with
Katan,
somebody else.
And
but,
the
like,
girl, Paula.
Yeah, and poor Tawny Katan. Like, my heart goes out to her, too, because she's part of the, you know, recovery world for me and the rehab world with Dr. Drew and on those shows and stuff. So she's part of that family. And, like, that woman was going through it. Like, a sociopath knows how to pick its target. You know, they know that they're looking for someone that they can, like, beat up. So, like, they can, like, you know, control, and they see someone and they prey on their weaknesses or their vulnerabilities. And, like, this woman was very vulnerable. This woman had a lot of things going on in her life. And I'm
What's funny is the episode that I released yesterday, I did, like, a whole, like, speech about Tawny Katan. Like, you know, like, I explained who she was as a person, like, you know, like, or how people would know her, like the hot woman on the, you know, the you know, muscle car or whatever on the music video. But I was like, she was a woman that was passed around, like, and very similar to probably, like, Nicole Brown Simpson, like, just passed around and discarded and it's just not okay.
And what people don't realize that if you're not in that space, if you're not in that world, like, and I mean the Hollywood world, and you're young and you're beautiful, or if you're in the modeling world, or if you're a young, beautiful, like, you will get passed around. Like, trust me. I mean, like, I understand it firsthand, like,
oh,
very
I,
well.
I know it happened
and,
to you. I know it happened
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, and, like, what people don't
understand,
they're like, oh, well, they
to, like, a slightly less degree, but yes.
Yeah, and it's hard, like, because they're like, oh, well, they shouldn't have, it was their fault. They shouldn't have been with all these guys. Well, no, you don't know any better, especially when you were never guided. Yeah. I mean, if you really want to, like, dig deeper, like, go into Tawny's life, I'm sure, I can guarantee you there's a lot of trauma, right, from child and all this. And then she's this beautiful girl, and then she's, like, thrown in this world. None of us know how to cope with Hollywood when you get thrown in. I mean, I got thrown in at 13. My family didn't even know how to deal with it with me. You know, like, I still sometimes don't even know how to deal with Hollywood. Like, but I mean, I have a greater sense of understanding today. I mean, I'm a lot older, but these girls were young and they were beautiful and they were thrown into these things. And then you just get kind of, you're right. You get passed around. You don't even realize you're getting passed around, you know?
Okay. Sounds good.
I love you so much. Thank you for this opportunity. I can't even believe how this unfolded this way.
It's amazing, and I love it.
I hope I gave you some good information.
Oh, you did, yeah. She got a good information.
Okay, good. I love you. I'll talk to you soon.
Love you. Right, bye.
January 1st, 1989. Nicole makes a heartbreaking and terrifying call to 911, where she is frantically screaming. You hear terrified, muffled screams. The 911 dispatcher immediately locates the address and sends LAPD out right then. She tells the officers she can actively hear the woman being beaten on the call.
Hello.
Officer John Edwards was a man that was dispatched to Rockingham, and I believe he will never forget that night. He knows it's serious. He arrives and pushes a security button on the gate to be let in. And he says, almost simultaneously, a tall female blonde comes running out of the bushes. She's wet, covered in mud, terrified. It was Nicole. She was just in a bra and sweatpants. She kept yelling, "He's going to kill me, he's going to kill me." And she ran to Officer John Edwards and collapsed in his arms. He asks, "Who is going to kill you?" And she says, "OJ, you guys have been up here 8 times before and all you do is talk to him and then leave. You guys never do anything and he's going to kill me." Her face was already swelling. She had an imprint on it. John asks, "Do you want me to have him arrested for beating you?" And she says, "Yes." Now, if this is really the law, this kind of confuses me. I haven't had the time to look into it, but if she was to say no, could they then just leave? Like, an abused woman, you know, sometimes does change her mind after, you know, calling the cops because she's afraid, and she will say no because she's afraid of, like, further abuse. But Nicole actually did that same thing at one point in the story when a cop came and she said no. They wanted to file charges and she said no. So is there a law in which the law enforcement can sort of enforce the arrest of the perpetrator in order to protect this woman? Or is it they can just decide yes or no in that moment? Because it kind of freaks me out. Now, if this is a law, it really confuses me, because what if she had said no? Could they then just leave? Because an abused woman sometimes does change her mind after calling the cops because she's afraid of her perpetrator. And so she will say no. Nicole actually did that at one point in this story when a cop came and she said no. He said, "Do you want to press charges?" And she said no. So it's kind of a confusing thing. I don't know the law. I haven't looked into it. I'm not a lawyer, obviously. But it is a little bit confusing and scary that, yeah, if she was in distress, if she was in, you know, harm's way, could the law enforcement officer just leave and leave her in that state if she just said no? I mean, it's confusing to me. But I digress. OJ then comes storming out of the house and starts yelling towards John Edwards and Nicole and saying, "I don't want her in my bed anymore. I got 2 other women. I don't want her in my bed anymore." That's actually what he says to Officer Edwards when he comes out storming through the gate with a savage look on his face and a vein in his forehead protruding from anger.
"When you hear a call come out and the 911 operator puts out on the call that she can hear the woman being beaten in the background, that's serious. When I got there, I saw an electronic buzzer system, so I pushed the button. Almost simultaneously, a tall female blonde came running out of the bushes. She's wearing nothing but a bra and sweatpants covered in mud. And she kept yelling, 'He's gonna kill me, he's gonna kill me.' When that gate opened, she ran up and just put her arms around me and collapsed on me. She was so wet and cold that you could feel her shivering to her bone. And I said, 'Well, who's going to kill you?' She said, 'OJ.' She says, 'You guys have been up here 8 times before. All you do is talk to him. You never do anything. He's going to kill me.' Her face had already swollen. She actually had an imprint on one side of her face and her forehead. So I said, 'Do you want him arrested for beating you?' She said, 'Yes.' About that time, OJ Simpson came right up to the fence and I started yelling. I don't want her in my bed anymore. I got two other women. I don't want her in my bed anymore. He's got a receding hairline, so you can see his forehead. And this vein was popping out, pulsating, and it was right up his forehead. I told him, I'm placing you under arrest for beating your wife. You're going to have to go get dressed so I can take you to jail. He turned around and went back in the house to get dressed. Suddenly, I saw a Bentley pull out the other driveway. So I said, back up. He's just trying to get away.
So Officer Edwards tries to catch up to him. He can't believe that he sees him pulling out in a Bentley in a different driveway and just making a break for it. This is 1993. To the outside world, Nicole was a happy, bubbly, devoted wife and caring mother. But behind closed doors, and to several law enforcement officers and even many friends of OJ's, even friends that only knew about the infidelities, but people that were aware that this woman was being forced to hide behind bruises, that she was in a relentless cycle of abuse. It's possible that many around them thought that the cheating was, you know, just something OJ did. And if they heard him speak about her terribly or speak to her terribly, maybe it was a one-off. Maybe they could, you know, sort of shrug it off. But they likely had no idea of the scope of his abuse and the fear she felt. And that's no excuse that if they thought it was a one-off, and, you know, but sometimes you don't know what's happening when it's happening, nor do you know how to intervene. I think it's a very difficult situation. But Nicole kept a diary. She would document her pain and the litany of verbal, emotional, and physical assaults to her body and her soul. In one instance, she found an earring in her bed, an earring that wasn't hers. And like any woman would, like, she would confront him. Meanwhile, by outside appearances, OJ and Nicole were flourishing. OJ was climbing the ladder of social status. In the documentary OJ Made in America, they say that Rockingham, the place in Brentwood that he lived in, was like his Graceland. Like, no one would say, hey, I'll meet you at OJ's house. They'd say, I'll meet you at Rockingham, as if it was its own entity. And Nicole melded into this world seamlessly. She ran Rockingham, and she made it a home. OJ was probably one of less than a dozen, if even that. Maybe less than that if you can count on one hand, of a black person to be living in the upscale Brentwood neighborhood of LA. But the Rockingham place was filled with the who's who. He was incredibly accepted because every man in that community, or at least the ones that paid attention to sports, were just so excited and starstruck to just be in this incredible athlete's orbit. And then he married a white woman and surpassed even more social norms of the time. OJ truly had transcended race in his mind and maybe other people's minds. The people that would come to his house were always celebrities in any form. The best athletes, prominent politicians, actors, celebrities of all types. They loved being amongst OJ. And he loved learning from them and networking with them and keeping them in his back pocket. If you'll remember from last week, OJ became the face of Hertz Rent-A-Car. He was sprinting around an airport in the commercial and people were rooting for him, like, of all races, creeds, colors, ages, saying, go OJ, go OJ. He became the face of Hertz, and he became a very dear friend of Hertz CEO Frank Olson. Frank Olson says, quote, I took him to places that I think very few black men had ever been. The Pine Valley Golf Club, the number one golf club in America. He got OJ into. And then he also got him into Alcala and got him a membership there. And when asked in the documentary, he said, was OJ the first black member there? And he said, by a long shot. In terms of street smarts, OJ was a genius. He could fit into anything so seamlessly with the elite, with the white crowd, but he could also hang with his black crowd. He was so good at becoming what people wanted him to be, or becoming what he needed to be in that moment to get what he wanted. He was magnetic. And frankly, I think he was a master manipulator. One of the most interesting lines in that documentary was by someone in his inner circle who says, there's something deep-seated that many of us have to face up to about how we created this complex character. It wasn't just him. It was us, part of society. And behind that winning smile and comedic chops, apparently, as OJ had a role in many Naked Gun movies, lied something darker, possibly bred from his childhood of growing up in the projects, a dad that abandoned him and came to find out was gay, a well-known drag queen who died of AIDS, partially because he was so well adored, he just kept skating by and kept getting away with stuff that his ego grew. Who really knows, but something along the way, the handsome athletic man, fueled by the country just absolutely falling in love with him, became, well, a bit of a monster. Meanwhile, you have sweet 18-year-old at the time then, Nicole, 23 when they married, funny, shy, innocent, with that cool surfer girl vibe. She also moved seamlessly in between OJ's friends from the projects and OJ's friends in the higher up elite. Nicole could really do it all. She was sweet. She was kind. She loved her little babies. Her family and friends absolutely adored her. But soon after their marriage in 1985, the man that was supposed to adore her the most in life, changed. But as we know from last episode, she did come back from their first date with her jeans ripped. So were the red flags there from the beginning? OJ will get what OJ wants at all costs. And if you cross him or displease him, OJ will react. And react, he did.
911 emergency.
Can you get someone over here now to 325 Gretna Green? He's back. Please.
Well, okay, what does he look like?
He's O.J. Simpson. I think you know his record. Could you just send somebody over here?
Okay, what is he doing there?
He just drove up again.
He just drove up. Okay, wait a minute. What kind of car is he in?
He's in a white Bronco, but first of all, he broke the back door down to get in.
Okay, wait a minute. What's your name?
Nicole Simpson.
Okay, is he the sportscaster or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. We're sending the police. What is he doing? Is he threatening you?
I'm going nuts.
Okay. Has he threatened you in any way, or is he just harassing you?
You're going to hear him in a minute. He's about to come in again.
Okay. Just stay on the line.
I don't want to stay on the line. He's going to beat the shit.
Wait a minute. Wait. Just stay on the line so we can know what's going on until the police get there, okay? Okay, Nicole?
Uh-huh.
Just a moment. Does he have any weapons?
I don't know.
Okay.
He went home. Now he's back.
Okay.
My kids are upstairs sleeping, and I don't want anything to happen.
Okay. Has he hit you today or no?
No.
Okay. You don't need any paramedics or anything?
Uh-uh.
Okay. You just want him to leave?
My door. He broke the whole back door in.
And then he left and he came back?
And he came and he practically knocked my upstairs door down, but he pounded it, and then he screamed and hollered, and I tried to get him out of the bedroom because the kids were sleeping in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then he wanted somebody's phone number, and I gave him my phone book and was gonna, or I gave, put my phone book down to write to write down the phone number that he wanted, and then he took my phone book with all my stuff in it.
The dispatch. The dispatch.
What? What does he say?
What the hell?
Just stay on the line, okay? Is he upset with something that you did?
Oh, a long time ago, it always comes back.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Hope you're enjoying the show. And if you are, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. And we may have some special interviews for this series. But stay tuned on that.